Hi everyone, my name is Shona Lane. I'm Education Officer here at the Western Plains Cultural Centre.
Joining me today are Ken, our curator.
Hi.
Caroline, our Assistant Curator.
Hello.
And Jess, our Collections Officer.
Hi.
Today we'll be discussing On the Sly, an exhibition curated by our very own Jessica Moore and currently on display in the museum space. On the Sly reflects on the nature of Dubbo as a town on the periphery and explores the lives of those who, by choice or necessity, have followed a darker path. The exhibition charts the story of three women embroiled in robbery, drug dealing, prostitution, gang warfare and murder, including Kate Lee, Jean Lee and Ruby Green. To commence our discussion, I'd like to ask Jess, as curator, what role you see these stories playing in our national history.
The exhibition is important because it connects in with a really strong narrative in Australian history, which is the fascination with and idealisation of the criminal. It's a very strong kind of character that we identify with as a nation, whether rightly or wrongly. But unfortunately, women don't get the same kind of folk hero status if they're a criminal. And so I was really interested in kind of looking at the lives that these women led and you know, looking at what the decisions they made and why they have been labelled as bad women and, you know, evil characters rather than the heroes that, say, Ned Kelly or Peter Layla might have, you know, characteristics attributed to them. So that was really why we went with the exhibition and why I think it's an interesting exhibition, because it looks at that sort of two sides of the same coin of the Australian criminal.
Yeah, I think there's also value in it as all history and the lessons that we can learn from the past and, you know, to avoid the mistakes that people have made before us. I think there's huge value in thinking about criminal history just on that basis alone.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the reason why I've always sort of been drawn to crime history is because, for me, it's history at its most intense. It's about really extreme emotions and experiences. And when you have to make decisions about your life that, you know, you're at the most intense moment of your life, and it can go really well for you, it can go really badly for you. And I think this exhibition, if it does one thing, I hope it's to show that we can't judge people based on a few decisions that they make or a few actions that they take and label them criminal and bad and evil and put them in that box, that actually the lives people lead are diverse and, you know, go off in tangents, and no one person is able to say they're a criminal, therefore they're bad.
Okay, you touched on something already in regard to our obsession with true crime and Australia's fascination with that type of underbelly of our culture. Why do we think that is? What is it about Australians that draws us to that?
Well, I think it's the opportunity for us to step back and view an aspect of the society that essentially we never touch on in our lives. We never really come into contact with those kinds of people. Even if our house gets broken into, you know, they've been there and they've left. We haven't made connections. We become a victim, but we don't really mix in those circles. So I think there's a sense of fascination because it's our opportunity to kind of get our feet dirty. And, you know, I think also we like to make judgments generally in our lives, and here's the opportunity to be very righteous and kind of say, well, yes, they were bad.
But I think also it's that these people do things that we never, ever think, ever enters our head that we would ever be able to do that. And so I think we're interested in the psychology of what is it about a person that leads them to think, to rationalise making a decision that involves becoming a criminal. And that, I think, is endlessly fascinating on a human nature kind of level.
Well, I think that we all at some point have thought of breaking the law or breaking rules. You know, I think everyone within them has a little rebel that's kind of, you know, just dying to kind of tip things up and see what happens. But of course we don't. We respect rules and, you know, live our lives, I suppose, in the way generally that is expected of us. But, you know, in looking at these kinds of figures, we can sort of, I suppose, fulfil those sort of little fantasies by proxy, you know, through someone else.
It's a sense of escapism, really, isn't it? Escaping
it is,
our mundane and experiencing it.
Yeah.
Thinking about something that Jess also touched on in regard to how male criminals in Australia's history have become heroes and yet females haven't been treated as such.
It's an interesting point. I wonder, I mean, I think in looking at this show, I think you can't look at Kate Lee without thinking, wow, what a woman. And I wonder whether there hasn't been the attention paid to these figures, like the majority of, you know, culture, male has dominated. And, you know, Ned Kelly, as an example, is someone who's been examined over and over and over again, whereas female criminals, whilst in the minority comparatively, are still very much out there. But I don't think that they've been examined as much.
And I think also there's the element that we pick up with in the exhibition about the fact that female criminals tend to commit their crimes in a domestic sphere. They're usually against family members, children, the weak, the vulnerable. And in that respect, that's because they're the people women access the most. That's the people who women have access to. But society looks down on them because they are kind of flipping the standards of feminine behaviour. They're not being caring, they're not being nurturing. They're inverting that. So that's why they're sort of doubly damned. They're a criminal, but they're also an unfeminine criminal. So whereas males tend to be, you know, the criminals that we look at are kind of as folk heroes are, you know, larrikins, and they're standing up for injustice, and they're defending the poor, and they're, you know, just not standing up to... They're standing up to authority and the kind of characteristics that we admire as Australians. So they're kind of heightening and intensifying that, whereas women criminals are doing everything to sort of support negative ideas of femininity. So I think that's why female criminals have been judged so harshly.
And what I think is really interesting about the show is that you are forced to take a position on each of these women. I think by far Tate Lee is the most complex in terms of the character that she presents. There's no two ways about it. She's a criminal. She did very bad things and got involved with very bad people was in charge of all of those bad people. But at the same time, she projects this very maternal, very...
Community-spirited
kind of character, which you kind of... You can't help but warm to slightly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Ruby Green is very much the victim. And you are sort of forced to sort of, I suppose, look at her as an innocent victim who essentially, you know, fell prey to...
She really gets lost in a historical period in Australian history where the issues that she faced, it just happened to be that at that time she had no other options. So she's kind of trapped in a social convention, really, that
That's
forces
right.
her... into sort of a very desperate act in which she had no other option to do.
Yeah.
So it's less about her criminality, but rather the pressures that people were placed in during the Depression that forced them into acts that, you know, turn normal people into criminals.
And I think she becomes an example of the result of criminal acts. I think in the essay, Jessica puts it quite well that, you know, for a moment... You know, the underbelly of Dubbo was exposed, and that case does really highlight this kind of other world that, you know, for all intents and purposes, still exists. It may not be in the same way, but in every society, there is that underworld that kind of exists without us really being aware of it until we sort of hear about reports, etc. And then, of course, Jean Lee is someone who sort of straddles both aspects. She's clearly a criminal, but whether she is someone that we can, you know, come down on 100% or whether she's a victim of circumstance, of mixing with the wrong people, but whether we like it or not, she was hanged for her crime. And I suppose that's the end result, the ultimate end result of of crime is to be hanged for it.
Well, considering the significance of the crimes of two of these women in particular in terms of national scale significance, it's something that came as very new to me, even being a local Dubbo person, and I'm sure that's the same for lots of people. Mm. And that sort of points to a difficulty that Dubbo has with acknowledging these types of things and the underbelly of the culture that, like Kent suggested, is still here today. Mm. What is it about Dubbo that resists that?
It's really interesting, actually. There was a vox pop in the Daily Liberal a few days ago about asking people on the street whether they think crime is worse now. And unanimously, everybody said yes. And I think it's really interesting to look at, you know, in researching this exhibition, the one thing that I found shocking was the fact that it is not any more... from what I understand, it doesn't seem to be there's any more crime now than there was in the 20s and 30s. It's just the kinds of crimes that maybe happen and the level of media that surrounds crime when it happens. So I don't know that Dubbo is particularly a crime-ridden city compared to any other kind of community of a similar size or whatever, but it's this sort of potentially this fixation on the fact that, you know, we've had several criminal events that have made national news, and that forces people to become overly kind of sensitive to it, and not wanting people to think that that's the only thing that we do here. And it's not. And there's a lot of people, a lot of really important people from Dubbo who've done great things on the national scale. But I think we need to temper their lives with looking at these people's lives as well, because I don't know that we can ever truly appreciate achievement and growth and development and success if we don't really understand the other side of that and the things we have to fight against to kind of achieve. So I would encourage Dubbo to sort of take this show as an example of kind of embracing all facets of its history and not overly focusing on the positive, but then also not overly focusing on the negative.
Mm. I think also, time is a great leveller. And, you know, it is much easier to look back at these three women who are in the past. We've got, you know, a sense of distance, and we can look at it in an entirely different way, whereas, you know, it's a little bit too unsettling to examine something that might be happening now, mm-hmm. because in a sense we could be implicated, you know, just by virtue of sort of living here. And
But the exact same debates happened in the 30s and 40s when Dubbo was going through its particularly sort of biggest crime period in the 30s. There was just as many discussions happening in the paper about how, you know, the Depression was causing all these, you know, wandering people to come into town, and who were they, and they were increasing the crime rate, and da-da-da. So at the time they were concerned about it. But then we look back now at the 30s and we think, well, that's probably a very peaceful, happy time. So it's all to do with context, and I think while ever it's current, it's always going to be a thing that causes concern for people.
I think also, you know, like most communities of a similar size and a similar kind, you know, you tend not to look at those kind of aspects of society. I mean, it's the underbelly for a reason. It's, you know, it's under the carpet. It's not out, and it has to be, because otherwise it wouldn't exist. And so I think there is certainly a preference for presenting, you know, a good face. And certainly Dubbo hasn't been without its kind of struggle to present itself as, you know, a successful, sophisticated, you know, community. But like anywhere, it you know, there's crime, and there always will be crime. And it has no more crime than any other place, or no less crime than any other place. I think that, you know, when we focus on particular aspects of, you know, crime or a community, etc., you know, things get sort of blown out of proportion. So I think that, you know, Dubbo has struggled in terms of its criminal past in much the same way as many other communities struggle with that. I think, you know, Sydney, as, you know, a big metropolis, has always struggled with that. But I suppose it has the beauty of size and can kind of at least shove all of the crime into particular areas, and then, of course, have all the well-to-do areas, you know, to counterbalance that. But I think that struggle is there, just like it is anywhere.
Yeah, I think it ultimately comes back to personal safety and well-being as well. The less we think about these types of things that are happening, the more safe and secure we feel. If we start to pay attention to them, then we all start to feel uncomfortable.
And that's exactly right.
Yeah, ignoring is the benefit of everyone, really. Yeah.
If you believe there's a boogeyman,
then, yeah, you know, there is.
There is.
All right, well, the last thing we'll think about in regard to on the sly is just what we can learn about ourselves and about human nature from the lives of these three women.
Well, I think the women in this exhibition highlight particular things that have happened socioeconomically, culturally, that have affected their experience. I think that, you know, we all sort of start from a particular place, and certain things happen in our lives that send us down a particular road, either consciously or unconsciously. And I think that these women do certainly highlight, you know, aspects of our society that most of us would, you know, abhor. But invariably, decisions are made along the way, and I think the exhibition highlights the decisions that they've made. But also, again, we as a viewer are implicated in the sense that we are forced to, you know, seriously examine why they made those decisions. Mm. Could they have made a better decision? How could they have, you know, stop themselves from getting into that kind of crowd, if you like. What we would have done in exactly the same situation. I think it's, I think shows like this force us to reflect on ourselves and the opportunities that we have, the decisions we've made. And as I was saying before, we, you know, we all like to judge, but ultimately, you know, we are, you know, we're all responsible for our own actions, and you know, a show like this sort of makes us question that.
I think for me, when I was putting the show together, one of the things that I was really interested in and that I hope comes out in the exhibition is the fact that we tend to view female criminals as poor, helpless, you know, they get dragged into some criminal behaviour and, you know, they're actually quite innocent and all of that sort of stuff. But actually, all three of these women made conscious choices about the actions that they took. And particularly for Kate Lee, she decided that for her, this world was the world that she felt she was going to be the most successful at, make the most money at. That was her, she actively sought out the criminal underworld. So I was really interested in the fact that some people choose crime as their life, you know, not for any other reason that that's what they want to do. And that, for me, opens up a whole lot more questions about the psychology of those people. And I think that for a lot of people who come to the exhibition, hopefully, what they get from the three stories is that we can never take these choices out of context from the historical period, but that any one of us from any background in any place in Australia is potentially able to become the next Kate Lee or the next, well, not the next Jean Lee anymore because we don't do that anymore, but so that it isn't a certain kind of person from a certain class or a certain background that becomes a criminal, but that it is purely based on, you know, some of the choices that we make as individuals. So people can kind of, you know, where you start out in life is not necessarily where you end up, and I think that is can be quite a depressing thing, but hopefully also it can be a positive thing as well.
Mm. I think the other thing as well is it forces us to examine those people and how we reconcile them within our culture and the culture of the time, etc. You know, I think if we look at Ned Kelly, why has he become a folk hero? What, you know, what is it about him that's heroic? And of course, in making the argument that he is a folk hero, one tends to ignore the bloodshed, the death.
I think, yeah, he's an interesting guy because if you'd put him in the 30s, he probably would have been one of Kate Lee's gangsters.
That's right.
We probably wouldn't look at him as much of a folk hero. He'd be a kind of inner city street gang member. Mm. Whereas because of the time and the context and where he was, it creates this different image of what a criminal would be.
That's right. And I think by examining crime history. And, you know, if you look at the underbelly programs, of which the next is to look specifically at Kate Lee and Tilly Devine, you know, there is a sense of that being presented in a very stylized, very attractive kind of way, which, again, makes us sort of ignore the actual violence, the actual kind of, you know, death, law-breaking, despicable things that happened. I mean, even, you know, if we look at, you know, someone like Chopper Reed, a pretty sadistic kind of man, but still has become this kind of comical character. And I think, you know, the same could be said of, you know, the three women, most particularly the two women who were guilty of crime. You know, whilst Kate Lee is this fascinating figure, she was still kind of brutal. She was still evil in some respects. And I think we've got to kind of remember that. Yeah. I think it's easy to glamorise it, but at the end of the day, if we became victims of any of that kind of crime, there's no way we'd accept the glamorisation of it.
No. I think there's also, in reflecting on human nature, what desperation compels us to do, especially in Ruby's case, extreme desperation, but also desperation on the other two. One was avoid an abusive father.
Yeah.
The other was also trying to survive as a single mother.
Yeah.
So, you know, early starts in life, they all struggled and were all desperate at one point, and what that leads to and the path that sort of leads you down is really interesting to think about as well.
Well, the three of them essentially were victims of, you know, the constructions of femininity of the time. You know, Ruby Green was fully aware of the implications of being a young unwed mother. That had serious impact on her life. She desperately tried to change it. Jean Lee was fully aware of her feminine wiles, that she knew that she could be a plaything for men, whilst at the same time thinking she had the upper hand, when in actual fact she became, you know, probably more a victim to those men. And then, of course, Kate Lee, who probably was the one who rose above the accepted idea of what a woman should be, and in a sense was a trailblazer in terms of feminism, in that she was someone who found, a particular niche that she was successful at, and she was a successful, strong female. Clearly within a questionable you know, area, but you can't deny
it. She found an area that she was successful in, but it just happened to be that it wasn't traditionally a female area.
That's right.
So she's a trailblazer in the sense that she wasn't the first female criminal or anything like that, but that she was
she made a success
in an area that was traditionally male, and she went into that world knowing that's I know myself and that's the world I know I'm going to be successful at, not necessarily making the best of a bad lot, but actually consciously deciding I can do this.
That's right. And at the same time, you know, really trying to fool everyone into thinking that she was a good woman, you know, that had Santa Claus at the Christmas party every year in Surrey Hills for all the kids.
Yeah.
Who can argue with that?
Okay, we'll leave our discussion of On the Sly there. And now we'll move on to what's happening at WPCC. Kent, can you tell us what's happening in the area of curating?
At the moment, we are installing an exhibition that is going to take up both the Children's Gallery and the Project Gallery. We've seen the deinstallation of the Goya exhibition, as well as the William Lamson show in the Children's Gallery, which will be both sadly missed. And those two spaces will be taken up by another in the Object Gallery's series of exhibitions that look at artists and craftspeople who have excelled in their particular area. And this time we are looking at the work of Jeff Mincham, who is an important Australian ceramicist. And so that will take up both of those spaces. It's a large, beautiful show. usual object quality, which is always high. So that will be really exciting. I've returned from Sydney after doing some research for the next show in the main space of the gallery, which is an exhibition called Adaptation, which looks at the work of Louise Hearman, a painter from Melbourne, and Louise Weaver, who is essentially a sculptor from Melbourne. And I'm looking at both of their practices and drawing out the similarities in their work.
Okay, thank you, Kent. Just in regard to Anzac Day coming up on the 25th, we'd like to invite everyone to come along to the Western Plains Cultural Centre for Anzac Day breakfast after the memorial service in Victoria Park, and to also join me for a guided tour of Icon and Archive, the travelling exhibition in the main gallery from the War Memorial. Okay, now we'll move to what's happening elsewhere. We're going to have a chat about the Archibald Prize. It's the 90th anniversary of the Archibald Prize this year, and the finalists have just been chosen.
Yes, the Archibald Prize happens every year. It's a bit of a circus. It occupies a really interesting place within Australian art. I think it's probably something that we like to think is national, but essentially it's a New South Wales thing.
I think it does bleed out a bit to other states,
but it really is an interesting project in that it is a hugely popular show. It's something that, in terms of audiences, is a real draw card, and certainly from our experience here at the Cultural Centre, the years that we've had it, it's a huge audience development exhibition. But of course, in terms of the art world, it's has an interesting position that it sits in, in that it doesn't really chart a particular mood within the art world, or it doesn't really say anything about the art world. Essentially, all it speaks to is a kind of populist notion of what constitutes a portrait.
For the amount of prize money that goes into it, and for its presence on the art sort of stage and its notoriety and the amount of time the media spends talking on it, it doesn't actually do anything to develop the Australian art world. From my point of view anyway, it's consistently the same artists get chosen every year, very much the same subject matter, same kinds of people are the subject matter. Every now and then there's one artwork that's thrown in as a kind of, always in this unusual, haven't they done something interesting? But it, on the whole, doesn't really propel the art world forward. It sort of, from my perspective anyway, seems to give credence and give support to the artists who are already established, and so that this is the kind of, if they've sold so many amount of works, they're in so many collections, and they've won the Archibald, it's kind of the thing they have to do. So I appreciate it and like it for its the fact that once a year at least the arts is the lead news story. But as someone who works in the arts, I can see that it is very much at a stage where it is not encouraging debate, it's not encouraging innovation, it's not supporting young artists, it's not doing any of the things that we as in the arts world all value.
In thinking about it from the general public's point of view, though, is it providing access to people who wouldn't normally access the world of art?
Certainly, the audiences are people who don't go to the arts will always go to the arts.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's fantastic, and I think it's great value. But they go and they may see the same artist for 10 to 15 years in it every year, and I don't think it's doing much to expand this sort of massive audiences. Appreciation of the arts because it's not challenging them very much.
It's very familiar and they're comfortable with it and they're used to the structure.
Exactly. So I don't know that the opportunity is being made use of. The fact that you have this guaranteed massive audience. Why don't we try and push them a bit further?
Why don't we
ask them to question things a bit? And it doesn't.
I think at the end of the day, it's not a barometer for what's happening in art. It's a barometer for audience opinion, public opinion.
Yeah.
That's all it does, is it allows us to see what people like and what they don't like. And the People's Choice is a big you know, plays a big role in presenting that. You know, it feels like it's been running for 90 years. It really does. And each year it's just kind of like, oh, yawn. I think it says more about the trustees of the Art Gallery of New South Wales, who are the ones that select the artwork for the show, you know, that it's often not challenging at all. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at something similar, you know, in the UK, like the Turner Prize, which is a challenging art prize, and it's similar in the sense that it you know, it grabs the attention of the masses in England each year without fail. It probably is a more a barometer of what's happening,
yes,
in the art world.
Yes.
And then, you know, the populace gets to comment on that, or, you know, be outraged, usually. Whereas the Archibald Prize is just sort of very predictable in terms of what it rolls out. In the most part, they're representational portraits of people. Every now and then someone will challenge the notion of what constitutes a portrait. And I think that the opportunity is there to do interesting things with it. I think, you know, you could bring in a curator each year. Mm. And certainly from the amount of people who apply each year, you could draw out any number of different shows. And really the fact that many of the same people get chosen is kind of really disappointing.
Mm. Okay, we'll leave our discussion of the Archibald Prize there. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Our next podcast session will be in a few weeks' time after the ANZAC weekend and public holidays. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.